Major funding for the series is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting with support from PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Margaret Cho, your host for Crossing East, our stories, our history, our America.
Well, in Vietnam, if you live with a GI, then they think you're part of too cheap.
I am Chinese, Greek, Swedish, English, Scottish, German, Pennsylvania, Dutch. I don't really consider that to be my identity. That's more my heritage.
I think we need to really reconcile ourselves to the fact that we are Korean. We were born in Korea. We look Korean. We're American. We live in America.
What I know of Vietnam is sort of what I see in, unfortunately, Vietnam War movies.
I was born in Changsha. I don't know what time, and I don't know exactly what day they estimated the day.
When we return, Brides and Children on Crossing East.
I'm Dee Mae Roberts with the Crossing East music feature. Jared Rayburg lives in New York City and writes about being adopted. For the longest time, he didn't even talk about what it meant to be an adoptee during Operation Baby Lift from Vietnam, but now he sings about it throughout the country.
I'm Jared Rayburg, and I grew up in Northborough, Massachusetts. When I first moved there, I believe there was three other Asians in our town. School was okay, but there were times when kids would call me names like, you know, Chink or a Gook, and I didn't really understand what they were calling me. For new teachers, they would say my name, and I would say here, and they would keep calling that name out, and they were looking for someone that, you know, matched, you know, the identity of Rayburg. I think my parents had tried to explain it to me, but I wasn't really interested, so I think I ignored them. They told me a little about the war. They told me there was a woman, you know, who was my birth mother. But, you know, I think I was trying so hard to be white that I didn't care about being Asian at the time. I wanted to be just like everybody else. But when you watch TV and you see people that look like you, or, you know, sometimes my parents would take me to a Chinese buffet and I'd see the people that looked just like me. But I didn't understand what they were saying, and they looked at me funny, and they'd always ask me, you know, do you speak Chinese? And I'd look at my parents, and they'd say no.
You can always find me running down empty streets.
Watch Over Me is the song I wrote about going back to Vietnam for the first time and trying to make peace with what I knew about my past and what I saw in Vietnam.
Beautiful children, postcards are gone. I try to escape, but it's too hot to run.
Yeah, the orphanage was a two-story building, and I got off the tour bus in the middle of Saigon, and I looked at the building, and I took a deep breath and told myself, you know, this was as far as I was going to get. There were moments where I was so relieved, you know, it was over. You know, finally, there it was. And then there was other emotions I had of, God, I wish that all of a sudden, you know, someone would come out of nowhere and tell me that they know who I was, you know. And at night at the hotel room, you know, I took some time and I pretended to speak to my birth parents, and I spoke out loud and I said, you know, I'm here, and I hope you're well, and, you know, wherever you are, whether you're dead or alive. But I made it. You know, overall, I'm pretty resolved about never meeting my birth parents. I do remember, you know, watching TV and seeing clips from Asia, and they would show lots of people on mopeds around the city. And I said to myself, someone in that picture, you know, may be related to me.
I see you on my TV, rushing home from work on crowded streets. You've got bills to pay and mouths to feed. Sending you my prayer for another day. Without me, without you, I'm living in America with a brand new name. Without me.
As an adoptee, we don't feel fully a part of the Asian American community. We don't feel a part of the white community. I'm an American. You know, my heritage is Vietnamese, but I'm American. And when I see people on the street, I expect them to speak English to me. But I know, you know, out there, you know, in some village, you know, maybe there's a woman, and she probably has children, and those children have probably grown up, and, you know, maybe for a moment she thinks about another child that she gave up, and and maybe my birth parents have passed away a long time ago, and I keep that memory with me too, and I know that they're looking down on me, and I hope that they're proud of me, and I hope that they know that I made the most of this opportunity.
Without you, without me, I'm living in America with a brand new name.
For more info about Jared Rayburg and his music, go to crossingeast.org. This Crossing East music feature was made possible by the National Endowment for the Arts. I'm Dee Mae Roberts.
I'm still the same. I'm still the same. Cardboard boxes anchored to the floor. Family and friends, now casualties of war. Hope for a new day, they scattered on the ground.
I'm Margaret Cho, your host for Crossing East, Our Stories, Our History, Our America. We present Brides and Children, the story of military brides and Asian adoptees. Chapter 1, The War Brides Act. After World War II, American men wanted to bring their brides back to America with them from Europe and Asia. The War Brides Act of 1945 made it possible, but it excluded Asian women who married American servicemen. Ji Yanya, professor of Asian American history at Northwestern University, says these women faced suspicion and prejudice.
There is a stereotype about Asian military brides that they're all former prostitutes and that they married the American soldier simply for social mobility, to escape a backward country and to come to the United States to pursue the American dream. The second reason is that there remains an image in the United States that Asia is this war-torn, ravaged, devastated area, economically poor, culturally, socially backwards, and therefore, who wouldn't want to escape if they could?
Many Japanese women working to support their families after the devastation of World War II fell in love with American soldiers stationed there. During the Korean War and later during the Vietnam War, the same thing happened, and young men and women endured ridicule, bureaucracy, and discrimination to stay together. Professor Ji Yanya.
Congress passed a series of exceptions to the War Brides Act, amendments, which gave basically a grace period, saying from X month to X month, soldiers in Japan can bring over their wives of Asian ancestry to the United States, despite the prohibition against doing so. In 1952, the U.S. immigration and naturalization laws were changed. That law, for the first time since 1924, eliminated the prohibition against migration from Asia and also overturned the U.S. naturalization law that prohibited Asian immigrants from naturalizing as U.S. citizens.
These women, known as war brides, or military brides, came to the U.S. in the thousands. Because their marriages were interracial as well as international, their experiences were different from other Asian immigrants. Here are the stories of three different women from Japan, Okinawa, and Vietnam who married American soldiers. Chapter 2, Military Brides, by Sarah Caswell Colbert and Dee Mae Roberts.
I don't know if American people could understand this old Japanese custom. And mom and dad find a husband for you. And you never even think about marrying a foreigner. And especially enemy was enemy not too long ago, you know?
Kazuko Umezu Stout grew up in the countryside of Japan and only realized the full devastation of World War II when she moved to Tokyo. She met and fell in love with a young American soldier named Carl, but was terrified of what her father might say.
When the car asked me to marry, I went home to get a okay from my dad, you know. And here come my aunt and uncle and cousin, all of that, for about 30 people. First thing my dad said was, I know my daughter more than anybody in this room, so just let her go. She's a stubborn. Once she said it, she's not going to back down. That's true. I didn't, so. And some members, their parents disowned them.
Maria Miyagi Bartruff was born in Okinawa and met her husband Dave in post-World War II Tokyo while he was still in the army.
So he was a writer, copy chief in Tokyo office, and grandfather relatives say, no. So nobody know when I married America because nobody see. I never invite anybody. We just two person. We just lunchtime we marry over there. So nobody relatives, no friend, nobody. Secret marriage.
For a few years, Maria and Dave lived in Japan and adopted a Japanese daughter, which confused the officials when they tried to bring her to the United States.
Actually, in December 1967, we adopted Emiko, getting her from the hospital.
I took pictures. This all of this her memories, pictures, baby pictures.
Like here is the court. She's the one that had to okay everything.
Because we got to bring it back to States. It took 6 months to okay.
During the Vietnam War, Wen Kim Denham ran away from home to Saigon at 16 years old. She met up with a madam who sold her to her future husband, a U.S. soldier.
I lived with him for 3 weeks. Then I get home sick. When I go home to my village, my father throw me out because I'm shaming the family. Well, in Vietnam, if you live with a GI, then they think you're positive, cheap. I locked myself in the house for a long, long, long time, maybe 6 months, because I never come out because I afraid of people. When he was shipped out, I think my world's going to end because I was pregnant at 16, 17 years old. And we cry a lot, but we couldn't communicate because I can't talk to him. He leave me some money. I even cry harder because I think he did bind me out. So he left, and I had a baby. Then he came back 17 months later and married me.
A Vietnamese military bride with biracial kids, Kim Denham faced racism even from her in-laws at a family reunion in Norman, Oklahoma.
And when I get there, his family of sick brother and sister, no one invite me to their house. And at Christmas morning, when my mother-in-law, who give all the grandchildren $20, except our two, they get $5. And they cried, and they didn't know why grandma's only give them $5.
Kim's loneliness was heightened by constant moving from military base to military base. Her kids were unsettled and lost friends. And Kim could never maintain friendships. The pressure of isolation built up, and she tried to kill herself by taking a whole bottle of aspirin.
I want to be loved because I had no one here. I'd rather be home with my people. I'm homesick. I don't know the language. I don't like the weather. I'm very miserable. First 2 years, I'd rather die. I was so hurt and so lonesome. And back home, I got lots of helps and all that. And when I came here, I had no one.
Many Asian military brides came to live in parts of America with few other Asians. Often, second or third generation Asian Americans didn't readily accept the new immigrants. Kazuko Stout.
I married my husband November 18, 1953. And April 54, I left Japan to go to Kentucky because he had a transplant. Japanese American people lived in here before. No, we called Ise. When they come to United States, their discrimination was so bad. They had a little land, and they worked morning to night. And here we come, wearing in high heel, you know, and they put the lipstick on, put the permanent on it. They didn't like it. Now, don't forget that you are Japanese. Don't make shame of it, you know.
And decades of negative press about Japanese war brides frustrated Kazuko. she decided to take action.
I said, we got to do something to change the image on the war bride. So in 88, I had a convention in Olympia, Washington, right here. And from all over the United States, 320 people showed up. That was just amazing. I had a consul general come from Seattle. I got a war bride speaker, a husband speaker. I gathered up the whole thing, and that was successful. And 15 reporters from Japan come. That made a lot of difference.
From Japan to America couldn't bring money much either.
Many military brides became the foundation for local Asian communities out of necessity.
Only $3,000 Japanese government say, okay, you can take money. Only $3,000. I got to do something because income, we got a living. So I started an Oriental folk art store, a large folk art, ceramics, silk.
I tell my kid that their father will buy me for $20. But he's good to me. We were married for 25 years.
Kim Denham.
But when the kid grow up and move out, we just sort of grow apart. I couldn't get work. I'm more than qualified to get sewing job, but no one give me a job. I get to the point that I said, I call for the job, but I'm Vietnamese. Would that make any difference?
But Kim persisted and found a steady job as a seamstress. She feels that despite the hardships, she does have a better life than she would in Vietnam.
America were land of opportunity. Women have a chance here to get good job and earn respect, which we don't have that in Vietnam. Lives are equals here. We don't have to walk 6 paces behind, and we don't have to keep our voice down. We can say what we think. Do what we like, which I like.
Oriental women work so hard and never give up.
Maria Bartruff echoes the endurance of thousands of military brides.
They are special strong mind they have because all the parties say no, 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 and they had been so hard time, you know.
And inspired by her convention, Kazuko Stout began the Nikkei International Marriage Society for Japanese War Brides with hundreds of members.
I think that 88 convention made this old war bride realized we're doing okay. This old, I could say, almost 90% of the war bride is strong, really strong ladies.
Military Brides by Sarah Caswell Colbert and Dee Mae Roberts with contributing producer Mia Kim. You heard the voices of Kazuko Umezu Stout, Maria Miyagi Bartruff, and Kim Denham. Thanks also to the Nikkei International Marriage Society. Today, most military bases have a support center specifically for international women married to servicemen, something not available to women we just heard. Often, women are cut off from any kind of support system and their home country. When we come back, the journey of one Korean military bride back to a homeland she hasn't seen in 32 years. I'm Margaret Cho. You're listening to Crossing East, our stories, our history, our America.
This is PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Margaret Cho. This is Crossing East. Our focus is on brides and children. Our next story is about a woman who hasn't been back to her home country in 32 years. Dr. Ji Yanya says it isn't all that uncommon for military brides.
The 100,000 Korean women who came to the United States as so-called war brides, or what I call military brides, began coming in 1950 and are still coming today at an estimated rate of about 1,000 a year. Overall, the research seems to show the marriages were less successful than what you might call a conventional marriage. Even when the marriage fails, it's not that common for the woman to return to Korea.
Ok Cha-young arrived with her husband in 1972. Like many military brides from Korea, she faced the stigma attached to marrying a U.S. soldier. And in the U.S., she faced the obstacles of being an immigrant woman, not knowing the language, not understanding customs, and having no family or community support. She eventually lost touch with her family. Finally, Ok Cha-young and her daughter, Rangjita, traveled to Korea to find her long-lost brothers and sisters. Chapter 3, The Story of Ok Cha-young by Rangjita Young Giesler.
I owe to myself, I want to say, my family last time. Close my chapter of my life when my father and mother passed away years ago when I was a kid. My brothers and sisters still there. I'd like to see them before anything happens.
I'm Rangjita Giesler, and today is Tuesday, August 31st. Today I'm leaving for Korea, and I'm going with my mother, and we're going back to try to find her family after 30 years. And also for me to find my cousins, to look in a similar face.
Welcome to Korea, where the local time is approximately 8:40. We will be texting for a few more minutes.
한국에서 I got an American one, and I just come back yesterday looking for Yang Du-sik. Since 32 years ago, I lost my brother. I want to find my brother. Then I got to go see where he looked. I'm looking for my brother, Yang Du-sik, and I haven't seen him.
There are a lot of
years.
Difficulties in trying to find her brother, but it just all flowed.
We're walking down the police station. He's gonna go in there, put it in. They can check it in the internet.
My dad was in the Air Force.
I got married. I went.
You got married.
This is my daughter.
Went to America, lost contact.
One thing led to another, and her question of, do you know Yang Du-sik? Do you know Yang Du-sik? It worked.
Oh my God, you look good. This is.
When I first saw her brother, Yang Du-sik, my uncle, in the hotel lobby, I loved him. I was like, he looks like my mom. And that was an intense moment for me just to see them, how similar they looked. And
I told you he's a nice looking man.
Yeah. I felt touched and sad and so many emotions when I saw him, and I felt connected. When I saw them hugging and being together, it was really sweet.
집에 가.
그래, 가지.
가자.
He wants to go. That's my brother's house. His house is the 9th floor. Beautiful. And he's calling people to come over.
Who's coming over tonight?
My brother, my sister, his kid, some friend.
The first day we met her older brother, we went to his house. That very night, the whole family came over.
Oh my Lord! Okay.
The doorbell rang. It was her younger brother with his family. And I had a lot of cousins who came to the house, so it was a full house. We had a lot of people. A little while later, my mother's half-sister came, who she raised. And so this was the first time they saw each other after 30 years. How's your sister handling seeing you again?
My sister seeing me again is very relieved. She was hurting a lot of years. She blamed herself that something happened to me or anything like that because she was her and I, it's like a mother-daughter relationship.
You in?
Mm-hmm. Tell her in Korean what you told me.
13년, you were 14살짜리야 when I left America. 14살. When I left Korea, that she was hurting until I met her. We reunited. Her
hurrying. It was a hill, lot hill. Her husband, going to her husband, her heart was broken. She needed to find me.
Let's recap the day we started out at 9 a.m. walking to City Hall.
Oh, 미국에서 여자가.
You know you're speaking Korean now to me?
Yes.
So how is that for you to speak Korean more and English?
I'm more messed up now. I'm speaking both. But I talk more American. I didn't speak Korean at all, hardly. Never, because I didn't know anybody to talk to. So no reason for me to talk. Because if I say Korean, nobody, everybody looks at me like, oh, what do you say? I didn't have a car. I didn't speak English. Where am I going to go?
Today is September 5th. Yeah. Already. Saturday already, and we're in the car going somewhere. We're in Suwon.
지금 영어로 뭐지? 치킨은 알지만 닭똥집 모르겠는데.
모래 주머니잖아. 모래 주머니.
What's that?
뭐 닭똥집.
This is chicken liver.
Chicken liver.
We call it 똥집.
Octopus.
What is that? She said that she wished her children could have been with their cousins and grown up and spoke Korean, just had the culture. And I think that that's one of her regrets, is that we weren't able to have this, our deep cultural roots growing up.
Do you remember these things?
Yeah, that's this week's steamy eating.
I also regret that too. And I'm trying to go back and learn more about my culture.
Yeah.
Oh, bugs.
No, you eat it. It's good.
Try it.
No, you do want it. Some?
Take one. No.
Can I try one?
She try one.
하나 먹어봐도 돼요?
저거 파는데.
You first.
Good.
Okay, mom.
You turn.
I'm gonna eat a bug. Ooh.
Mmm.
이제 이거 바깥에서 따뜻하게.
What kind of bug?
In back of my mind, that I never left home. That's how my mind was. You know, just something in my body is somewhere else, but I'm still there. But when I come to America country, my husband's mother and come and apple greet us, the woman I never met in my life, I cry on her shoulder. How long I cry? I never met her before in my life. That's when it hit me that I would not go back to my own, and after a while, you know you're not going to go back. I mean, simple as that.
So me and my mom have been here for 8 days, and we've gone to so many temples and mountains, and my mom talked to her brothers about the good old days. What did you guys talk about?
How we grow up, what we have to do, why my father always beating the crap out of my younger brother and older brother.
How did you guys grow up? Because I didn't speak Korean, so I didn't hear it.
Very poor. We didn't have much to eat. We didn't have much of anything. We're happy. I raised my younger sister, but actually myself. My mom had to get up 3 in the morning to go to market. She used to come in 10, 9 at night. We were solely my mother and father. Father passed when we were young. And my mother's help wasn't that good. But my mother had to do whatever she had to do. Put the food in the table. We're so poor. My mom worked hard. But then she didn't appreciate what I done. She took everything to granted. And that's when I say, heck with it, everything gone. Then on that moment on, I take care of myself, nobody else.
I learned a lot about my mother on this trip. And when she was with her family, I learned so much. Even though they were speaking Korean most of the time and she would speak broken English, from the pictures and conversations and what was translated to me, I learned that she really had a hard, really hard life, and she struggled a lot, and I feel like her to leave that for a better life in America was her goal, that she fell in love, yes.
Why do you think you wanted to leave Korea besides my dad?
Not besides I want to leave Korea. I didn't want to leave Korea. It's that you don't have a choice. You marry somebody, you go with it wherever he go. It's not a choice. You just got to do it. That's it. It's not a choice.
When she met my dad, she didn't speak English and he didn't speak very much Korean. So I wanted to know, like, why are you with this man who you couldn't really communicate with? And she said, it's just love. You can't stop it.
There was a lot of people, Korean people, at the time asked that they didn't believe in that. You marrying some outside another country.
When I speak to my mother, she gets uncomfortable when I bring up the subject of military brides and having her talk about specifically being a military bride because of the negative stereotypes that many women, especially Korean military brides, face and have faced in the past.
Yes, felt that circumstance, my brother, my whole family did very well, and they're pretty close, happy.
Go?
A lot of people came with us to the airport to see us off, but it was like everything led up to that moment of leaving and that they didn't want to leave the airport. They were following us everywhere. They were standing in line with us. They made us eat before we left. It was just, it felt like, wow, this is my family. They're very close and they want us to be here because of the love we felt in 18 days, how close we came to them. It was like she had never left almost, you know?
This is really it. Bye.
Bye.
Growing up as the daughter of a military bride, I didn't really think about it. I just realized that it was different. As I learned more about my mother, I realized who she was as a young woman and what she had to go through and having her trust me enough to open up.
But now my peace is very happy. Finally, yes, I'm glad they found themselves happiness.
That's and it. You too.
Yep.
The story of Okcha Young by Rangjita Young Geisler. Rangjita tried very hard to get her mom to answer questions about her experiences as a military bride, but it wasn't something that Okcha wanted to talk about. Dr. Ji Yanya says it's not unusual for military brides to be reluctant to share what is usually a painful memory. Often, the brides are the only contact many Americans had with Asian culture.
When schools began to have an interest in diversity and multiculturalism and began to hold international fairs or multicultural fairs, military brides began to be called on to display their home cultures for this mainstream American audience. They often serve as guides to the newly arrived relatives, help them get jobs, help them put their children in schools, help them deal with the INS and immigration papers, and so on and so forth. Military brides tend to go everywhere. They go to suburbs, small towns, rural areas. They go to Appalachia. They go to the American Southwest. They go to Montana because that's where their husbands and their in-laws are. In those places, they often tend to be the only representative of Asians, of Asian Americans, of Asian immigrants.
Rangjita, like so many children of military families, faced this question.
Throughout my life, I've been asked, so what are you anyway, in that sort of quizzical stare.
It's a question that many multicultural Asian Americans have heard throughout their lives. Answering it was difficult for those born in the 50s and 60s when interracial marriages were not as common as today. Many had no name for their identity and relied on half this, half the other. As decades moved on, the answer has been constantly changing. And for many, the question can be tiring to hear. Rangjita returns with this exploration of multiracial identity. Chapter 4, I Am.
Who am I? To answer the question, who am I?
My first answer is usually Asian American.
I am a fusion child.
I rarely say that I'm half black, half Filipino.
My mother is a native of Tokyo, Japan.
Being half black and half Vietnamese.
Half something. And I never really considered myself half of anything. I considered myself both.
If I had to answer the question, what are you?
I am an Asian American Hapa boy. That's always the big question. How do you want to be known?
I am Chinese, Greek, Swedish, English, Scottish, German. In Pennsylvania Dutch. I don't really consider that to be my identity. That's more my heritage.
Throughout my life, I've been asked, so what are you anyway, in that sort of quizzical stare.
I am a fusion child from the Hawaiian Islands. They would call me a Hapa Haole, which is someone that is mixed, that has Asian ancestry, but also my background is English, Irish, and German.
Amerasian.
Mongrel.
Hapa.
Half-breed.
Mixed.
when I walk down the street, people see a black man. They also know that I might be mixed. And a lot of people say, oh, you must be mixed. You look like you're mixed.
The word Amerasian has kind of gone through some changes. In general, the term Amerasian has to do with having a military-based U.S. citizen father and an Asian national mother.
Amerasian. I never really identify with Amerasian. I think that, to me, it focused on the experience of the half-Vietnamese, half-American children.
The term Amerasian was popular around the, you know, 50s, 60s, 70s, and even people were still using it in the 80s. In the 90s, the word hapa started to become really popular, and that's a native Hawaiian word.
I don't necessarily identify on a regular basis as hapa. I'll just come forward and say black and Filipino.
The term doubles, that's one that I really identify with, because hapa means half, or hafu, right? Half something. And I never really considered myself half of anything. I considered myself both.
We often struggle with who we are and who other people think we are, or who we want to be and who other people want us to be. And it's a constant pushing and pulling.
How many Chinese people have come up to me and said, oh, are you Chinese? Because my name, Wei Ming, is Chinese. And when I say yes, they say, but you're not really Chinese, or really? You're Chinese? I can't believe you're Chinese, you know? But nobody's ever said to me, when I tell them that I am Hapa or that I'm an Asian American of mixed heritage, nobody's ever denied me that.
I feel an other in that I'm enough of a mix that I don't really have anyone besides my immediate family who are my same exact ethnic background.
It's interesting watching people's eyes light up and all of a sudden they have this renewed interest in you that stems from almost as a question as if, you know, how is it possible that this mix can come together?
My father, African American, and Choctaw Indian. My mother, Japanese. So those three heritages, I mean, I look at the legacy. Africans, basically enslaved. Indians, basically a subject of genocide. And the Japanese Americans, interned and imprisoned, all by reason of race.
I have learned so much about the complexity of race and race relations just by looking at how things operated on, you know, my mom's side of the family, the Filipino side, and my dad's side of the family, the black side, and where I fit in and where I didn't fit in on both sides.
If there are parts about yourself that you're not comfortable with or you don't know about, I think it makes it more difficult to put yourself out. It's almost like you're not a whole person yet. You're still missing things and you don't understand things about yourself.
It's been a challenge, but at the same time, I've become really comfortable with being both fully all the time, every single day, instead of feeling fragmented.
Once I became more whole, I think it was a lot easier for me to take the risk to build relationships with people.
I can relate to other people who have been struggling in many ways with having multiple ethnic origins because it complicates things to be honest about what your background is.
I feel I have to work harder at just being whole, but that's fine with me. I accept it. It's like, this is the way that it is. This is the way that it's going to be.
Know thyself. And the truth will set you free, and you will gain strength through knowing who you are. I think that really encapsulates the mindset of really looking and capitalizing on all those things that you are and building strength or gaining strength from all those differences.
I Am by Rangita Young Geisler featured the voices of Daniel Morey Schwinn, Julie Ty Underhill, Wei Ming Dariotis, Janet Stickman, Anthony Brown, and Khan Oxelson. In a moment, Korean adoptees search for their unanswerable questions. I'm Margaret Cho.
You're listening to PRI, Public Radio International.
Cardboard boxes, anchors to the floor, family and friends, now casualties of war. Hope for a new day, they scattered on the ground. Jane lost her baby when the plane went down.
she ever wanted was to save the child. Do what's right, give one a better life, this life. Empty boxes.
You're listening to Brides and Children. I'm your host, Margaret Cho. The Korean War ended in 1953, leaving many children poverty-stricken or orphaned by the war. Americans started adopting Korean children in the 1950s. Though adoptive parents may have meant well, the emphasis was on cutting ties to Korea and raising the children in mostly white communities. More than 100,000 Korean adoptees live in the U.S., with more arriving every day.
Liner President Cleveland heads into port, and on board is a happy little Korean orphan, 5-year-old Kim Koo-pil. He's got his passport, he's got a new home in America, and he's got new parents, too. And now, after months of complications and delay, brings him home to peaceful America.
But Korean adoptees found a different America that was not so peaceful. In Chapter 5, Korean adoptees find hope in themselves and each other. Here is Unanswerable Questions.
I was adopted with my older sister and younger brother. We came to the States together because our birth mother insisted that we stay together.
It was awful. I mean, I was adopted when I was 7, and immediately all the kids on the playground either wanted to fight me or just wanted to call me names. Things change, you know, as you get older. The kids get used to you, but there's always that struggle of being Asian in a very white society.
I think so many parents get caught up in they want a baby, they want a child, and once they get that child, they think the journey ends with that, and really that's just the beginning. Because in any transracial adoption, you can't raise that child like they're white because they never will be.
I'm not sure exactly what date I was born. It was somewhere around 1950. And when I was around 4.5 years old, my father disappeared. Right around that period, my mother had brought me to a street corner and told me to look down the street and not turn back. And that was the last time I saw her. So I was living on the streets for a while until I was found by a Methodist missionary nurse. And she brought me to an orphanage. Congress had passed an acceptance of international adoptees in 1957, and I was adopted into the U.S. in 1958.
I was born as Hyunju and came to the States, and my adoptive parents named me Crystal. But then when I was in college and started meeting more Koreans, I rediscovered my name.
I grew up in a primarily Caucasian neighborhood. I knew I wasn't white, but feeling as though I wanted to be white my entire life. And I think it influenced feelings of, you know, self-hate, really hating the fact that I was Asian or Korean.
At that time, adoptions were being done very differently in that agencies were advising parents to assimilate us into the white culture as quickly as possible, give us American names, and basically help us to forget about the past and start over in a new life.
My mom cared for me enough to, you know, give me a better life. And then she gave me up January 1st, which is New Year's. And in Chinese calendar, New Year's is the luckiest day of the whole entire year. So I feel that my mom gave me away with as much luck as possible.
So I met my father, and it was an incredible reunion. He walked into my hotel room, and the first thing he said to me was, "I'm so sorry that I couldn't do my duties to you as your father."
I've actually been in situations where I've walked past African-American men of a particular generation, and it's just struck me, you know, if he served in the Korean War, that man could be my father.
In Korea, actually, other Koreans would get very angry with me and scold me for not knowing Korean or Korean customs. So it's like this constant struggle throughout your whole life.
South Korea is no longer a third world country, yet it continues to send its children out to other Western countries. And I just want to ask why.
When I go to Korean cultural events and I see little kids learning how to drum and how to dance and those things, like, I never had that opportunity.
Who are my parents? What am I doing here? Why was I given up? What would have life been like if I had stayed in Korea? And these are unanswerable questions.
Again, I would reiterate to adoptive families as much as they can do to integrate the culture. The next generation of adoptees maybe help them to grapple with some of their issues of identity. We are a country that takes people literally at face value. You are what you look like. I think we need to really reconcile ourselves to the fact that we are Korean. We were born in Korea. We look Korean. We're American. We live in America.
I feel very comfortable just kind of hanging out with our Korean adoptee friends because it's not so confusing. And I think there's like a mutual understanding that we can kind of act like whatever we want because we have this common bond.
I am really pleased by just how much more Korean Americans are taking more of an interest in the experiences of adopted Koreans. And I hope to see more of Korean Americans embracing adopted Koreans into their community, but for reasons of seeing us as being equals and something to contribute, as opposed to having feelings of guilt and feelings that they want to help us.
Unanswerable Questions by Sarah Caswell Colbert and Mia Kim featured the voices of writer Katie Robinson, Ruben Chapelhine, Kate Herz, Hyunju Chapelhine, Johnny Collins, writer Thomas Clement, Lowell Rojan, and Deborah Johnson.
Spring at home. But unmindful of clock or calendar, the Vietnam struggle goes on.
As the Vietnam War came to an end in 1975, U.S. assisted orphanages in Vietnam feared that if North Vietnam were victorious, all the children might be killed. Humanitarian groups suggested as many children as possible be taken out of the country. On April 3, 1975, President Gerald Ford announced that up to 70,000 children would be flown out of the country to the United States. Around 2,700 arrived and were adopted in the U.S. before the fall of Saigon on April 15th. Now adults, these adoptees share their search for a sense of self. Chapter 6, Baby Pictures.
I am Shannon Hetrick. I was born in September 10th, 1972. This was during the Vietnam War. I came over to the United States in April of 1975, and this was through Operation Baby Lift.
I'm Richard Silver. And I was adopted from South Vietnam in 1974.
I'm Jared Rayberg. Yeah, Betty Tisdale ran my orphanage back in Vietnam. She and Madam Nai, they were responsible for saving the lives of 219 children.
I am Betty Tisdale. The government arranged, I guess, with President Ford that these agencies could get their children out, but I was not involved in that. So I had to try to get my own planes, get a place for them, make sure that they got adopted, all of that on my own.
When we boarded the plane, Betty and Madam Nai made up names for us and gave us birthdays, and we were on our way to a better life.
And we didn't have birth certificates because these were abandoned children. They're left at the gates, and these children had never left the orphanage, let alone get in an airplane. And they were all adopted within a month. Those babies were my babies, and I would have taken all of them if I could have. I would have adopted all of them.
Damaged planes at Da Nang Air Base are one result of a long-range rocket shelling attack by Viet Cong, which also destroyed several military buildings. A powerful new Russian-made weapon is blazing.
What I know of Vietnam is sort of what I see in, unfortunately, Vietnam War movies. I do think more recently I've kind of been interested in Vietnam and learning a little bit more about it. My parents, they were told, you know, it would be a good idea to expose me to the Vietnamese culture. But when they did, I was actually quite resistant to it. Growing up in the South, the last thing you want to do is bring attention to yourself.
There's going to be a point in your life where you have to recognize who you are. There's a point where you're going to realize, I need to have some of these questions answered.
In August was the first time that I met other Asian adoptees as an adult. I got to meet other adoptees who were from the Operation Baby Lift. And to me, it sort of felt like that was an extended family because only those people kind of understand completely what I went through growing up.
I met Richard Silver on the trip to Vietnam this summer.
The purpose of the trip was to commemorate
the 30th anniversary of Operation Baby Lift.
We landing in the airport called Tonsnut, which is the airport in Ho Chi Minh City.
For me, I went with the attitude that not only am I representing the United States of America, but I'm also representing my heritage as a Vietnamese.
I got to play at the Reunification Palace. Very few people have played that palace, and you know, I got up on stage and plugged in my guitar. I looked out at the country officials, and without being dramatic, I got to tell you, I was thinking about my birth parents and thinking, you know, this was the closest I was going to be to communicating with them.
Not a flesh of my flesh.
One of my most special moments that will stay with me forever is my time in the orphanage. Because while I was there, I could imagine in my mind what I would have been like when I was in the orphanage.
Operation Baby Lift, homeward bound. I hope everybody has enjoyed your trip.
What I got out of my visit in Vietnam was how proud I am of the country that I came from. The images that we have 25 years ago or 30 years ago of this chaos and stricken land, you don't see that. The people that I talked with who knew that I was back after 30 years, you know, they asked, what do you think of Vietnam now? I was truthfully honest by saying, I really love this place.
The pictures that I have at the airport, the Atlanta airport, of me arriving here, that's where I had always thought my life began. But now that I've had sort of firsthand accounts of what happened, I guess I believe now.
You know, in some village, you know, maybe there's a woman, and, you know, maybe for a moment she thinks about the child that she gave up, you know, and maybe my birth parents have passed away. And I hope that they're proud of me, and I hope that they know that I made the most of this opportunity.
Baby pictures included the voices of Richard Silver, Shannon Hetrick, Betty Tisdale, and the voice and music of Jared Rayburg. Every year, approximately 5,000 children from China are adopted into the United States. Beginning in the 1990s, China replaced South Korea as the leading sending country of Asian adopted children to the United States. In 1992, the Chinese government passed laws enabling foreigners to adopt Chinese children. There's no doubt that international adoption is changing the landscape of American life. Our final chapter, Where I'm From.
I'm Ying Ying Fry, and right now I'm 11 years old, and I live in San Francisco. 我的名字叫傅英，今年十一岁. I was born in Changsha. I don't know what time, and I don't know exactly what day they estimated the day.
I'm Amy Klatskin, and I'm Ying Ying's mom.
And I'm Terry Fry, Ying's dad.
We traveled to China on 10 days' notice. All we knew about her was her orphanage name, Zhou Sheng.
In China, and the local Chinese-American community gave us their perspectives about how would the local communities accept her and accept us as a family.
We had a lot of support from friends in China, from our Chinese teacher in particular. Chinese-American friends here were very, very supportive, so we felt we had a community to help raise our child. And living in San Francisco, we felt that we could bring her to a place where she would be in the majority.
I was adopted from Jiangxi province.
I was adopted from Wuhan when I was 7 months old.
My parents are Caucasian. I have one brother, two sisters.
When you go to restaurants, people look at you, and it's really weird. It feels odd.
I like learning Chinese, so when I go to China to meet my biological parents, I like to speak with them.
The Korean-American adoptees are making themselves available to tell us what it was like for them, if we'll only just listen.
Our friends and our age of people, when we were adopted, we went to places like in Ohio, or Minnesota, a lot of people, Michigan.
It's important to have an adult role model who is Chinese. It's every bit as important to have an adult adoptee as role model in her life.
Our names were changed to very Anglo-sounding names. Do you know what that means?
Yeah.
We must start the story of our children's lives when they were born, just like everybody else. Because a lot of adopted kids are 6 or 7 years old, they think they were never born. And so that gave me a sort of structure to be able to start her story always with growing in her birth mother's tummy, is how I used to say it. Getting bigger and bigger, and finally she was ready to come out, and boom, she was born. And then there were 10 weeks and we don't know what happened.
Well, when my friend went to her orphanage, that's when I decided I wanted to go back and visit my orphanage.
She wanted to make that connection, I think, that even though it's China and even though they speak Chinese, that their lives were a lot like her life. And she went over and over again to the room that had the babies that were the age that she was, 4.5 months when she was adopted. And she would just stand and a shadow would pass over her face.
I think she wanted to explore her story, to know more of
yes.
it and to understand it more. That's what comes out a lot in her book.
The name of the book is called Kids Like Me in China. 我喜欢中国，希望可以再去。 Hi, my name is Yingying. I like China. I hope I can go back to China. I'd like to go to the Great Wall and walk a long time. Go back to my orphanage and see the little kids.
You know, whenever we go back to China every year, year and a half, and each time we're there, we ask her if she wants to go to the police station and look, see if they have any files on her, the police station that recorded her information when she was found. And so far, she hasn't wanted to do that.
I don't want to do it right now because just one more thing to worry about. And I think I'll do it maybe in high school or something. It's really unlikely that I'll find them because they might have died or they might have gone away to a different province. And so it'd be really hard. Anything could happen to them, and I'm not quite sure whether I want to do it or I don't.
It's very common for all children to some extent, but particularly adopted children, to try to protect us, the parents. They don't want to hurt us. And it's not just that. I mean, these are kids who have actually lost a set of parents, and they know it, you know, by the time they're 6 or 7. They know it.
Forever family is like a family that takes care of you and cares about you for the rest of your life. Not your parents that gave birth to you, but the people that actually take care of you and make a home for you and stuff.
There's a time when we can only listen and support our kids when they're dealing with some big issues that, as parents, we would love to be able to fix, but we can't.
Both of my families, they're the same because they both cared about me, but except for one couldn't take care of me and the other could, but they both loved me, both of my families.
Without you, without me, I'm waking up American on a brand new day, and I'm still the same.
Where I'm From, by producer Dee Mae Roberts and Mia Kim, featured the voices of Yingying Fry, Amy Klatskin, Terry Fry, and fellow adoptees Maya, Zaji, Maylee, Yang, Maggie, and Cam. We came in many waves. Across oceans, across lands, we married men who came to fight. We came as babies left behind by wars and poverty. We gave birth to new generations of Americans. This is Crossing East, our stories, our history, our America. I'm Margaret Cho.
Crossing East is produced with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and from the National Endowment for the Arts, Bob and Olga Fredrickson, and individual donors of Media Rights Productions. Our lead scholar is Judy Young, Professor Emeritus of American Studies at UC Santa Cruz. Music was provided by Jared Rayberg. Our theme music is by Shasta Tycho. The managing editor is Catherine Stifter. The associate producer is Sarah Caswell Colbert. The Crossing East engineer is Clark Salzberg, with technical assistance by Michael Johnson. Our outreach director is Ping Ka. The executive producer is Dee Mae Roberts. To find out more about Crossing East, go to crossingeast.org. Support for Crossing East comes from this station and Public Radio International stations and is made possible in part by the PRI Series Fund.
PRI, Public Radio International.